of us mortals is how much they have on automatic. When the bulk of what an expert does is on automatic, people say she has great intuitions. Hence, learning a skill really well enables you to go faster, so that you can then go slower. Going faster means you have more time to give to the harder parts, the parts that require your executive functioning. And it is going slow that allows executive function to take over. On the other hand, overloading attention shrinks mental control. Learning a skill really well helps prevent the skill from overloading your attention. In sum, with practice and preparation, what at first requires lots of energy and attention needs to become automatic. Learning your field really, really well enables that. Your mind is freed up and quicker to focus on the extras that really make a difference. Now we can also understand better why preparation increases our agility. Giuliani noted, "I would prepare for everything I could think of so that I'd be prepared for the thing I hadn't thought of." Why is that? Because by being prepared, when new circumstances arise that you haven't anticipated, your brain has the working memory available to attend to those issues. When should you prepare? The short answer to "when should you prepare?" is before you need to. But to be more specific, there are two times to prepare. Before the task. The most effective preparation is done in advance of the need. Before Rudy Giuliani became mayor of New York City, he did vast amounts of reading and brought together the best experts to essentially give himself a class in all aspects of running a city well. That is an example of very thorough advanced preparation. You don't have to go to that extent, but here are a few examples of prior preparation. Before a meeting. Define the purpose of the meeting and create the agenda. That is a very easy way to prepare. Even if you aren't running the meeting, review the agenda in advance, if it's distributed, and jot down some initial contributions you feel you can make. Before taking on new responsibilities. When you are given new responsibilities in your job, or life, for example, starting a family, find a couple of the best books on the subject and read them, or talk to others who have been effective with those responsibilities or roles. When a major challenge or opportunity comes up. When something unexpected, whether a problem or opportunity comes up, don't just rush in. Take some time to reflect and do some learning. Simultaneously with the task. Of course, we can't prepare for or anticipate everything in advance. By preparing for more things in advance, though, we will be more able to devote our mental resources to doing the preparation that we need to do as we go in certain areas as well. Simultaneous preparation is preparation that you have to do while attending to a task. A new project might be given to you, and you haven't done anything like it before, and it starts right away. There isn't time to do much prior preparation. You have to learn as you go, analogous to a design-build approach in construction. Include in the time you plan for doing the tasks some time to learn as you go. This can be effective and also can help you avoid the trap of getting stuck in continual prior preparation, just preparing, preparing, and preparing, and never doing. Simultaneous preparation is also an aspect of ongoing adapting. Willie Peterson brings this out well in his excellent book, Strategic Learning. He makes learning and situation analysis a phase at the start of the strategy process, but then he also makes it a step at the end, thus creating a cycle of learning that continues. You develop strategy, do it, observe and learn, then refine the strategy. Thus, learning, preparing, becomes a continual process, integrating into how you do things. The strategic learning process is a process of continuously learning from your environment and your own actions, then adjusting your strategies in light of those insights, and thus navigating through the current needs while at the same time building capacity and readiness for the next challenges. Creating the time for preparation. How do you create the time to prepare? Two things here. Don't sacrifice preparation for efficiency. First, decide not to skip the time to prepare. The temptation to do so can be strong. Justin Menkes expands on this in Executive Intelligence. Because we know speed is of the essence, too often we immediately start moving without first taking the time to think about what we're trying to accomplish. There are hundreds of stories about this. Everyone is trying to act quickly, but too often they run out to solve a problem without fully understanding what they are trying to solve. Remember, go slow to go fast. Preparing at the start may initially take a bit more time, but will ultimately speed things up because more will be on autopilot for you. Shape your job to include preparation. Second, the best way to create time for preparation is to shape your job to include time for it. This may at first seem extravagant, but it is not at all. It is essential, given what we have seen on the benefits and necessity of preparation. To think that including time to prepare in your actual work responsibilities is not real work is to fall for the fallacy of valuing only production, not also production capacity. You don't have to overdo it by committing massive amounts of time to preparation. Craft your job to include what time you can for preparation. How to prepare. When it's time to prepare, how do you do it? Here are a few principles for how to prepare. Prepare deeply. Learn the fundamentals. You cannot just do surface-level preparation. Many people think they are preparing, but they are only skimming the surface. For example, you can't just do tactical preparation, what Tim Sanders calls gathering resources, organizing them, and practicing my craft. You have to do fundamental preparation. You need to know the fundamental concepts of your subject area, the principles that make the practices work, so that you can adapt the practices when circumstances change. You need to know why the area you are preparing for matters, which will enable you to remain motivated and truly connect things. And you need to know the history of the area, so that you can see the effects that different approaches have had over time, and not repeat mistakes. Such preparation will require a lot of hard work. Tim Sanders writes, "To be deeply prepared, you'll need to delve into your challenge, often tapping into a different part of yourself than you were used to. Deep preparation is strenuous and taxing. It will push you outside your comfort zone. To the outsider who's happy just to get by in life, it will look like overkill. Only the obsessive would go that far. That is why most people end up choosing to prepare at the surface level." Practice, and know what practice actually is. It has been well said that mastery takes focus and deliberate effort. That's what practice is, focus and deliberate effort. Many people misunderstand the meaning of practice. They think it just means doing something a lot. But that is not practice. That is mere repetition. Mere repetition does not make you better. Practice doesn't mean just doing something a lot. It means working deliberately to improve. That is, as you practice, you observe your actions and make course corrections. On the other hand, if you are just doing something a lot, you could be reinforcing bad habits. Practice is what makes it possible to improvise and respond to the unexpected. Remember that to improve at anything, including personal leadership and execution, you need to push yourself. This is how you develop capacity at the physical level, and it is also true in the mental, emotional, and spiritual dimensions. And so it needs to be a key component of how you build your capacity through preparation. Tim Sanders notes, "To truly get smart, you'll have to strain yourself on many levels. You'll read more than you ever thought you would. You'll have to think purposefully about what you've read and digest it into nuggets of insight. You'll need to put yourself out there, discussing these nuggets with colleagues and being willing to debate the issues. Often you'll have to employ creative powers, associating unrelated facts or examples to give new insights. As you are practicing, include obstacles and challenges in the process so that you are preparing for reality. Create mental models. By preparing and practicing, you are creating a mental model of the skill and area. This is not just study. It's study with intent to apply. You are preparing for the sake of turning knowledge into action. Mental models enable you to interpret the world as you go about your work and life. They enable you to understand why things are the way they are, and therefore how to change them. And they enable you to make predictions and test them. You will continually refine your mental models. In Smarter, Faster, Better, The Transformative Power of Real Productivity, Charles Duhigg has an excellent discussion of mental models and how they enable pilots to fly with skill and avoid crashes in challenging situations. Duhigg says that mental models help with information overload, organizing our knowledge to make it more efficient. They help us by providing a scaffold for the torrent of information that constantly surrounds us. How do you create and use mental models? Duhigg points out that we create and use mental models by constantly developing theories on why things are happening the way they are and testing those theories. We constantly tell ourselves stories about why things are happening the way they are. As we do this, our mental spotlight is ready to shine right away when we encounter a problem, and we will be able to pay attention to what matters without getting overwhelmed and distracted by the constant flow of information. Using our knowledge and talking with others also helps us understand it more deeply, remember it, and refine our models. Find other people to hear your theories and challenge them, Duhigg advises. As you do this, you'll see that this is not just brute knowledge you are developing. Mental models are about making connections. That's what learning itself is, making connections between ideas, not just knowing them. In sum, to become genuinely productive, we must take control of our attention. We must build mental models that put us firmly in charge. Research shows that people who know how to manage their attention and who habitually build robust mental models tend to earn more money and get better grades. And anyone can learn to habitually construct mental models. By developing a habit of telling ourselves stories about what's going on around us, we learn to sharpen where our attention goes. Narrate your life as you are living it, and you'll encode those experiences deeper in your brain. If you need to improve your focus and learn to avoid distractions, take a moment to visualize, with as much detail as possible, what you are about to do. It is easier to know what's ahead when there's a well-rounded script inside your head. Gaining knowledge by reading. One of the best ways to gain knowledge is by reading. Here is a summary of how to use reading to prepare. Your aim. This is key. Your aim in reading is not first to gather details or to just plain read. Your aim is to find the central governing idea of the subject. Without this, you will not be able to get a sense of the whole, and the specific parts and aspects of the subject will not gel together in your mind effectively. Most people do not realize that there is a single governing idea behind most concepts. You have to grasp this idea, because without it, you will not understand the area. Many experts in various fields have vast knowledge, but do not truly understand their area. That is, they do not have wisdom, because they are missing the core idea, or have the wrong one. The process. Here is a summary of the process. First, find the best books on a subject. You can start to find the best books by asking people who are familiar with the subject. Then, review what they've pointed you to on Amazon, reading the endorsements and some customer reviews, and usually the top two or three books will emerge. Note that books should be chosen over magazines and blog posts. Books bring depth. News and articles tend to bring awareness, which is helpful, but doesn't generally take you to the roots. Second, read the books, looking for the big ideas and the overall framework. Underline while you are reading. Third, after reading a book, go back over it and take some key notes. This is crucial, as you need multiple exposures. Fourth, as you read additional books, relate the concepts to each other. Real learning takes place when you relate ideas rather than simply having them in your head. Fifth, integrate the notes. This is the synthesis process. It helps you relate ideas even more fully. Sixth, review the notes and put the concepts to use. For example, when I was given leadership of the web department at Desiring God, I followed the previous process to learn usability, our core philosophy for the website design. After I had integrated my notes, I started using them. That is, I used the principles of usability and information architecture I had learned to develop the site blueprints. This really cemented the concepts in my mind. Seventh, as you are learning, connect things to your experience, especially by using the ORID process. Learning is not just the objective information. There are actually four steps to learning, not one. The four steps spell ORID. 1. Objective. This is learning the facts. It is essential, but it is not everything there is to learning. To think that it is reduces learning to mere information transfer. But that's not what learning is. Learning is understanding the concepts, being changed by them, and being able to use them. This implies much more than just knowing the facts, which leads to the next steps. 2. Reflective. Adults learn especially by connecting knowledge to their experience. That's what the reflective step is. Take the objective information and think about a time you've experienced it in your life. That really starts to anchor the concept. For example, when I was learning usability principles and thought about inferior websites I had encountered that violated the principles, that was the reflective step. 3. Interpretive. As you reflect, look for patterns and develop insights into why things have the effect they do. This helps you understand even more deeply, as you can now interpret the knowledge and make predictions. For example, when I was learning usability, I came to understand that most sites that are easy to use have a clear global navigation. Why is that? Because a good global navigation gives you the big picture of the site. It creates an easy framework for you. Understanding not just the what, but the why, enables you to much more fully grasp the concept. 4. Decisional. This is where you take the patterns you've learned from the objective knowledge and make decisions about what you will do differently now, and implement them. This is the central component of learning. It is the concept linking to and changing behavior. For example, after we learned why global navigation is so essential for a usable website, we created the global navigation for our site based on the principles we had learned. We were doing things differently because of what we learned and applying it. And this enabled us to see it fully in action and truly be changed by the learning. The importance of connecting learning to experience should not be overlooked. Interestingly, since learning usability principles worked so well for me by taking the notes and integrating them, a few years later, I sought to do this with leadership as well. I read almost 20 books on leadership, took notes, and integrated them. I expected the same thing to happen. But it didn't. I certainly learned some things, but it wasn't clicking like usability was. Why not? It was too much. And I didn't have enough background knowledge from experience yet, the R in the ORID. I was simply seeking to connect the facts to one another, not to my own experience. I wasn't thinking of times, for example, when I had utilized a certain leadership style, and good or bad results had followed. I was just thinking about leadership style in general. This negligence prevented the deep learning I needed to do and made the subject stick less. This finally began to turn when I began connecting what I was learning to experience. Interestingly, as we in fact just saw, this connection to experience was essential for me in learning usability as well. I reflected on bad websites that violated the principles, did the interpretive step to understand why, and made decisions to do things differently. I followed the full ORID. For some reason, with my initial leadership study, I focused only on the O. That was a big mistake that cost me time and lots of energy. 8. Use your knowledge through doing and speaking. We've already talked about the importance of doing. Another thing that helps is talking about what you were learning. Talking about applying knowledge makes it stick. Rote memorization and repetition do not. This is one reason, perhaps, that it was much harder for me to learn time management than theology. Although I've read much more on time management, I understand theology far better than time management. Why hasn't time management connected and stuck as much? Part of the reason is the work of the Spirit and my gifting. But another is that as I was learning theology, I always sought to make use of new knowledge right away and to talk about it with my friends. I would write articles, for example. Instead of just taking notes over a book, which I typically did with the time management books, I would write an article articulating my own thinking and conclusions on the subject, informed by the books. Doing that enabled me to truly grasp things in a way that stuck. Of course, reading is great, and so is talking about things, but we will not make connections until we take time to reflect and draw conclusions. What to learn for the workplace. Develop a philosophy for your position. One of the most important types of preparation you can do is develop a philosophy for your position. This serves as a strategy and set of guiding principles to anchor your actions in a consistent, effective framework. So take some time to develop a specific philosophy for your role. You can do this by reading some of the best thinkers on the subject and then drawing conclusions based on your own experience. For example, if you are in internet and marketing, read some of Seth Godin's writings. If you are in human resources, read Laszlo Bock's Work Rules, insights from inside Google that will transform how you live and lead. If you are a freelancer, read Daniel Pink's Free Agent Nation, The Future of Working for Yourself. If you are a manager, read Marcus Buckingham's First, Break All the Rules, What the World's Greatest Managers Do Differently. If you are a top executive, read Jim Collins's Built to Last, Successful Habits of Visionary Companies. Prepare in areas that aren't your main view. As a leader, you need to have firsthand knowledge of as much as possible. Rudy Giuliani writes, "Sometimes you have to know the material as well as the experts who work for you. That's the only way to develop an independent view and not be held captive by the people around you, who may want to spin in one direction or the other. By getting firsthand knowledge, you will be more able to identify spin and protect yourself from it." Know your company's business model. Knowing how your company makes money is crucial so that you can work in alignment with what brings in revenue rather than against it. You want to be a revenue-positive employee, not a revenue-negative employee. So know what a business model is. It's what your company does over and over to make money. Exactly what your company's business model is, and how your job contributes to it. Especially, do those things in your job that make the biggest contribution to the business model and eliminate the things that don't, without guilt, but also without making the mistake of superficial efficiency. Know how your organization works. You can do your own job more effectively if you have an understanding of the total organization, how it all works together. Understand the parts of a business and the specific departments in your own business or nonprofit. Talk to people in each area to learn what they do, and read a book or two on how business works, such as Stephen A. Silbiger's The 10-Day MBA, a step-by-step guide to mastering the skills taught in America's top business schools. Be aware of your environment. Keep an eye on changes in trends, and keep innovating so you can adapt and do new things. Hone your professional skills. Improve your reading, writing, public speaking, and the specific content skills of your job. Adapt to specific challenges that arise. When there is a challenge, learn as much as you can about it as soon as you can. What to learn? There is also much to learn about. Here are just a few things to highlight. Understand the Christian faith. If you are going to be unstuck and effective in carrying out God's purpose, you need to understand the Christian faith very well. All Christians are called to understand the Bible and theology well. First of all, you must know the difference between religion and having a relationship with Jesus. Christianity is first of all a relationship with Christ, not a set of rules or behavior modification. One of the best and most enjoyable recent discussions of this is Jefferson Bettke's book, Jesus is Greater Than Religion. Second, you must understand the great doctrines of the faith so that you can articulate them. The best book here is Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology. Also important is understanding apologetics, how to defend the faith. The best book here is William Lane Craig's Reasonable Faith, Christian Truth and Apologetics. You also need to understand cultural engagement so you can point the world to Christ without turning them off through spiritual weirdness, lack of tact, and lack of social intelligence. As Paul says, we are to walk in wisdom toward outsiders, Colossians 4, verse 5. One of the best resources here is Tim Keller's Center Church, Doing Balanced, Gospel-Centered Ministry in Your City. It is not just for pastors, but for all Christians. Understand economics. Understanding economics is also important, as many seemingly well-intentioned policies actually hurt more than they help. This is because many politicians overlook basic economic principles in formulating their positions. We have a responsibility to be informed citizens, and understanding economics helps us discern good policies from bad, which is important for the flourishing of our communities and nation. The best book on economics is Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics, A Common Sense Guide to the Economy. Know how to love your spouse and kids. If you have a family, you can serve your spouse and kids by learning more fully what your spouse needs and what it means to be an effective parent. Some of this comes naturally to us, but some doesn't. So there is a place to do much learning. One of the best and most accessible books on marriage is Shanti Feldhahn's The Surprising Secrets of Highly Happy Marriages, The Little Things That Make a Big Difference. One of the best books on parenting is Grace-Based Parenting, Set Your Family Free by Tim Kimmel. Organizations. Train your people. Finally, a word to managers and organizations. Train your people. This is part of preparation as an institution. Jim Collins nails it. Train people at all levels, not just managers. Keep in mind that training isn't a perk. It's a tremendous business advantage. What do you need to train your people in? Customer service employees need product knowledge, of course, but they also need, along with all employees, emotional and social intelligence, not just technical skills. We all need to know how to relate to people well. This includes skills like empathic listening, not being judgmental or critical, and being affirming. Do not miss this. Project management training now points out that most projects fail not due to lack of technical skills, but due to insufficient people skills. Training people in authentic and good social and emotional intelligence is essential for effectiveness in the workplace. Various training methods may include reading, audio messages, videos, apprenticeship programs where seasoned, successful employees educate new people, outside training courses, and courses that you develop inside the organization. What about smaller companies? They need training in people skills too. In fact, they need it most. Many smaller companies complain that they don't have the resources to do training. We ask them, how can you possibly expect to develop into a great company without it? Tools for learning more quickly. Here are three quick tools for learning more quickly. Rapid learning. Liz Wiseman talks about rapid learning in her excellent book, Rookie Smarts. She recommends that you see how fast you can ascend the learning curve. You don't have to become an expert in everything, but you can get halfway, and that can make a huge difference. Don't just learn enough to be dangerous. Learn enough to stay out of danger. Learn enough to know the right questions to ask. Then find the right people to ask and let the true experts answer them. Becoming an expert can be an arduous, lengthy process, but one can quickly learn the basics and the latest developments through deliberate inquiry. To do this, interview experts and ask them to teach you the essentials of their field or their expertise. Speed leading. The speed leader implements what I call simultaneous preparation. Instead of preparing and acting, they act, learn from the consequences, and adapt based on those. Acting first and in small ways can generate important insight for traversing unknown territory. Speed reading, sort of. I've never been able to make speed reading work, but you can use the underlying concepts to read faster. One key concept is not to look back and reread, but force yourself to keep going forward by using your finger as a pacer. This also helps you speed up. Eventually, you can try to read chunks of words at a time. What to do with your preparation? What can you do with your preparation? Use it, of course, and instill preparedness in others. Once again, this connects to doing good and always building others up. As Giuliani notes, creating reasons for those who work for you to establish their own culture of preparedness is part of being a good leader. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. Preparation is central to effectiveness because it puts routine elements of a task on autopilot so that you can give your focus to the higher level challenges involved. Exercise. For what activities in your work and life are you especially prepared? How frequently and well are you using this preparation? For what do you need to do deeper preparation? Part 3. Personal Management. The Clock. Getting your time unstuck. The ability to be successful, relaxed, and in control during these fertile but turbulent times demands new ways of thinking and working. There is a great need for new methods, technologies, and work habits to help us get on top of our world. David Allen. How we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. Annie Dillard. You are probably wondering how you can translate your vision and strategy into your daily life. Envisioning and strategizing is not enough. You have to organize in a way that aligns with and supports your goals. And you need to know how to do it at the macro level, in the day-to-day, with specific tasks and workflow. And so you need a process, one that is adaptive and allows you to respond to new opportunities and changing circumstances. If it doesn't, you will miss key opportunities, or stay on a road that environmental changes show will not pan out. By analogy, the road may have been flooded or be undergoing construction work. Your approach must stay true to your vision and values, or you will drive off course and accomplish nothing. Further, your mission matters and must be accomplished. The world and the kingdom of God will miss out if you fail to follow through on your mission. We must, as Jim Collins often says about great organizations, preserve the core, missions and values, and stimulate progress by being willing to adapt everything else as we move along, finding the best path to our goal. Following is the process for personal management. I will outline the whole process here, and in the chapters that follow, I will cover the core components in detail. The process of managing yourself. Analyze and consolidate time. When it comes to managing yourself, your plan does not actually come first. Instead, you first need to know how you are actually spending your time, what time wasters you can get rid of, and how much time you have left to work with. Then, you will be in position to create a good plan. Hence, the first step is to assess and analyze the way you are currently spending your time. We will look at this in Chapter 11. Start with your time, not with your tasks. Determine the chief areas of your job. With the amount of time you have to work with clear and consolidated into large chunks, you can then determine the major areas of your job where you need to be spending your time. After that, in the next step, Identify the key activities you need to be doing in those time periods. The steps here include the following. Determining your core strategy concept and value proposition. Identifying the chief categories of your job. This is crucial because you cannot successfully manage your time if you don't know how you should be spending it. The biggest problem new managers and most people face is understanding their goals and priorities. They're not really sure what they should be doing. The result is spending your time working on the wrong things, being driven by the urgent, or being pulled by others to accomplish their agendas. There will usually be 4 to 7 main areas. Chief categories include the following. Growth tasks. Things like innovation, product development, process improvement, and personal development. Leading and managing people. Things like developing vision and strategy. Communicating the vision and strategy. Planning and facilitating meetings. Motivating people. And holding reviews. If you are a leader or manager, these are the main activities of your job. Ongoing daily operational activities. If you are an individual contributor, these are the main areas of your job. They might include designing buildings if you are an architect, writing code if you are a programmer, or designing website interfaces if you are a graphic designer. Administrative tasks. Things like compiling expense reports, setting up meetings, and arranging travel. Determining how much time each category of your job needs. Create a time plan. Now, within each results area of your job, determine which specific activities you need to do in them. Then, use these determinations to create a time plan, a simple chart listing the chief categories of your job, how much time each gets, and what the key activities are in them. Compare this chart to your actual time allocation from your time audit and make adjustments as necessary. Note, you may need to add staff or obtain additional resources to get your job done. The last step here is to put the priority activities you've identified into your schedule. Your aim is to allocate your time to the activities that will generate the biggest return toward your goals. Create your task management system. Your personal management system as a whole consists not just of a literal task management system, but of processes and methods as well as structures and systems. Since I have dealt with creating a task management system in What's Best Next, we are not going to focus here on the specific structures of the task management system, such as to-do lists. Nevertheless, understanding what the components of a full task management system are is helpful. The key components are these. 1. Your mission statement. 2. Your role plans. 3. Your project and action lists. 4. Your calendar. 5. Your contacts, files, journals, and other supporting systems. 6. Your methods and practices for keeping your system going. Daily workflow, weekly planning, execution in the moment, and longer-term planning. Note that your personal management system is more than a calendar. Many tasks and projects don't have a good spot in a calendar, nor do your mission statement, vision, and goals. A quick word on software. Unfortunately, no single app will organize all the elements of your management system. You may, for example, keep your mission statement in a document, your role plans in an Outliner program. I recommend Omni Outliner, and I keep my mission statement there also. Your project and action lists in a task management program like Omni Focus, your schedule in a calendar program, and your procedural checklists in Evernote. Execute. Make decisions consistent with your priorities. As you implement your management system, work to keep your tasks in their time boundaries by controlling to plan. That is, identify ways you may be letting your work expand beyond scope, and identify shortcuts to get it done faster. These principles from Robert Posen's Extreme Productivity especially help with controlling to plan. Focus on the final product. In tackling high-priority projects, quickly formulate tentative conclusions to guide your work. Don't sweat the small stuff. Deal with low-priority items in a way that allows you to spend as little time on them as possible. One of the aims of a good approach to personal management is to enable you to get into the zone easily. The zone is the state in which you are able to do your best work in the most efficient way. It is when you are operating at your highest capacity. Your mind is clear and you are fully engaged, doing proactive and productive things. You are not stressed and you are wholly absorbed in the activity. You feel in control and time seems to disappear. You are making clear progress toward outcomes that matter to you, and you feel it. You can adjust certain characteristics of the work itself to help you get into this state, and you can control certain features of your environment to keep them from interfering. Working in the zone is increasingly necessary to energize you and protect you from burning out as your environment becomes more demanding. As Allen says, this is more and more a required condition for higher performance professionals who wish to maintain balance and a consistent positive output in their work. We will look at how to get into the zone in chapters 13 and 14 on deep work. When we get out of the zone too much and for too long, we begin to feel less in control, more stressed, less focused, and stuck. Being stuck is both a feeling and result of not being in the zone. It is to be doing your work in a way that is not energizing and fulfilling. You feel less in control and more frazzled. And being out of the zone leads to being stuck further, because being in the zone is the engine by which you move and progress. When you are out of the zone, you can be like a car that is spinning its wheels, stuck in the snow or mud. But when you are in the zone, you are like a truck that has sufficient traction and horsepower to move, despite the snow and despite the mud. Being in the zone is our power for moving from here to there, and thus is essential to getting unstuck and not being stuck. The objective is to be able to devote your full attention to the task you are doing, being completely absorbed in it, and yet also to have this ability under your control so that it doesn't just happen by chance, or, alternatively, so that you don't have to constantly try to get into this state only to fail. The aim, flourishing. The aim of working in the zone is flourishing for yourself, for the world, and for the kingdom of God. By flourishing for yourself, I mean not only that you are getting the right things done, which includes having appropriate proportion between your four fundamental needs and the five main areas of your life, but that you are also doing the work in a way that is relaxed and energizing, not hurried and exasperating. David Allen, perhaps without intending to connect his words to the concept of human flourishing, captures this concept well in the goal of his GTD, getting things done, approach. There is a way to get a grip on it all, stay relaxed, and get meaningful things done with minimal effort across the whole spectrum of your life and work. You can experience what the martial artists call a mind like water, and top athletes refer to as the zone, within the complex world in which you're engaged. Transitioning from personal leadership to personal management is like shifting gears. Transitioning from personal leadership to personal management is like shifting gears. Multiple gears are needed to get unstuck. Consider being stuck in the mud. You start out in the highest power gear. First, that's vision. It will get you out of the mud. It's inspiring, providing power. It provides the most power of any step, and direction, so that you don't fly out of the mud and into the trees. But once you are out of the mud, you can't stay in first gear. You have to shift in order to keep going. And that's essential to getting unstuck, because if you are out of the mud but then can't get to where you want to go, you're just stuck in a different sense. Second gear is personal management. It provides less power, but more control. Third gear is the laser, enabling you to break blocks. And though we aren't talking about them in this book, the fourth gear is leadership, getting others involved to do bigger things, and management, bringing a measure of control and stability to those things, essentially analogous to the process of personal leadership and personal management. This is the approach you must use to get your life unstuck, and then you repeat it to get specific obstacles unstuck. You ask, where am I? Where do I want to go? What's the problem and reason for the gap? What's the path? Chapter 11. Start with your time, not with your tasks. You need to start in the opposite place you might think. Work expands to fill whatever time is allotted to it. To be productive, therefore, you must manage your time, not your work. Jim Collins. Peter Drucker starts off the second chapter of his classic book, The Effective Executive, The Definitive Guide to Getting the Right Things Done, with a big surprise. Most discussions of the executive's task start with the advice to plan one's work. This sounds eminently plausible. The only thing wrong with it is that it rarely works. The plans always remain on paper, always remain good intentions. They seldom turn into achievement. That is, the plans get stuck. A plan is precisely the thing we would intuitively come up with to make sure the most important things get done. So why does starting with a plan result in getting stuck? Why don't the plans get done? Because counterintuitively, we need to reverse the order. Instead of starting with our plans and then arranging our time to sync with our plans, we need to set the table with our time so that we can then put our plans into it. In other words, we have to make room for our plans. You would think you could just use your plan to overrule what you might otherwise do with your time, but in practice, that does not work. Other things, the prior things, the urgent things, will crowd out your planned work and be almost impossible to overcome. Drucker sums up the process that actually works. Effective executives, in my observation, do not start with their tasks. They start with their time. And they do not start out with planning. They start by finding out where their time actually goes. Then, they attempt to manage their time and to cut back unproductive demands on their time. Finally, they consolidate their discretionary time into the largest possible continuing units. So, we have a three-step process here. One, record your time and identify where it is actually going. Two, cut out the unproductive demands on your time. This is what Drucker calls time management. We typically use the phrase more broadly. Three, consolidate the remaining time. I can testify that Drucker's process here works because I have tried literally everything possible to avoid it. This is because by nature, I have very little interest in the first step, tracking my time. I think I probably speak for most people in this. Who wants to write down what they're doing every 5 minutes? And yet, I found that I've never achieved the results I'm capable of in a smooth and non-overwhelming way without following Drucker's approach and starting with my time rather than tasks. So, unfortunately, if you truly want to maximize your effectiveness, this is something you must do. I am truly sorry. Why start with your time? Tasks are unlimited. The biggest reason we have to start with our time is because that's where the limitation is. The supply of time never goes up. You can't make more of it. Tasks, on the other hand, are infinite. There can always be more. So if you start with your tasks, there can be no end. But if you start with your time, you can contain your tasks to the most essential and not constantly be overwhelmed and behind. The next 2 points help us understand this idea better. Time is the new scarcity. Drucker points out that the limits of any process are set by the scarcest resource. Let's say you want to take a trip to the Himalayas and hike up to the base of Mount Everest. This expedition will cost $4,000 and take 10 days. Further, it requires excellent physical condition. Let's say you have $10,000 in the bank that you were able to spend on this trip, and that you meet the physical conditions required. But due to work commitments, you only have 7 days available. Can you make the expedition? It doesn't matter that you have far more money than is needed to pay for the trip. The time you have available is insufficient and is the limiting factor. You will need to find a different expedition that requires less time, or you won't be able to go at all. Even having all the money in the world would not change this. The scarcest resource sets the limits. With performance and accomplishment, we need three resource inputs: time, money, and people. Which one is the scarcest? Most people think it's money. This explains why so many managers and organizations are focused on cost-cutting, even at the expense of their employees' well-being. They have a misguided understanding of what is scarcest, and it skews their decision-making. Money is not the scarcest resource. As Drucker pointed out years ago, and it has only increased since then, of the other major resources, money is actually quite plentiful. And when it comes to people, while it is hard to find enough good people, you can hire and train more people. But you cannot get more time. You cannot rent more of it, hire more of it, or in any other way obtain more of it. Time is the scarcest resource, not people and not money. And therefore, nothing else perhaps distinguishes effective executives as much as their tender, loving care of time. This is true especially today, about 20 years after Drucker last revised The Effective Executive. We are bombarded with requests for our attention and with complicated situations that demand our time. Yet most people continue to think that money is the scarcest resource and that we ought to focus our efforts on saving money. As mentioned previously, this thinking results in unhelpful and detrimental decisions. Since time is scarcer than money, we should focus our efforts on saving time over money. We should be willing to spend money to save time, because we can get more money, but we can't get more time. This simple change in orientation would make many organizations much better places to work, and reduce stress, and increase well-being, and therefore productivity for their employees. Time is inelastic, perishable, irreplaceable, and necessary. At this point in his discussion, Drucker has the best summary of the characteristics of time that I have ever seen. Many people try to make these points, as they are the precise reason that we need to care about time management at all, but Drucker makes them in the most concise and compelling fashion of all. He points out the following reasons why we need time management, listing these characteristics of time. Inelastic. No matter how high the demand, the supply of time will never go up. Perishable. You cannot store time. What you don't use can't be put in the fridge or the bank, but goes away forever. Time is therefore always in exceedingly short supply. Irreplaceable. You can often substitute one resource for another. If we run out of almond milk, I can put regular milk in my coffee. A manufacturer can, within limits, use copper instead of aluminum. But there is no substitute for time. Necessary. Not everything requires money or even people to do. But everything requires time. It is the only truly universal condition. All work takes place in time and uses up time. As Jonathan Edwards said so well in his sermon on procrastination, time is exceedingly precious. Yet, as Drucker points out, most people take for granted this unique, irreplaceable, and necessary resource. Don't be one of those people. You cannot accomplish what you are called to do without good stewardship of your time. If you waste your time, you will waste your life. Or, to put it conversely, if you are on board with John Piper's call to not waste your life, then you need to learn time management so you don't waste your time. And that point brings us to the three-step process for managing our time, so that we can then make the most of our time for the sake of the God-centered priorities we define. Track your time. While it can seem burdensome, the good news about tracking your time is that you don't need to do it constantly. Once a year for a week should be enough. But once is not enough, because you will likely drift back into old habits. Constant effort at managing time is required to keep from drifting. I suggest starting right now. Decide to track your time from this moment for the next week. To do so, you can go high-tech or low-tech. If you want to go low-tech, carry a journal with you and record it in the journal. If you want to go mid-tech, use a Word document or Excel spreadsheet. And if you want to go high-tech, use an app such as Hours or Hours Tracker. How do you do this well? The first rule of tracking your time is not to rely on your memory, as it will not be accurate. Psychological experiments have shown that our time sense is not very reliable. We tend to grossly underrate it or overrate it. Drucker points out that in his experience with executives, he has seen this over and over again. I sometimes ask executives who pride themselves on their memory to put down their guess as to how they spend their own time. Then, I lock these guesses away for a few weeks or months. In the meantime, the executives run an actual time record on themselves. There is never much resemblance between the way these men thought they used their time and their actual records. So don't rely on your memory. Instead, in your journal, every 15 minutes, stop to write down how you've been spending your time. Do your time log in real time. Eliminate time wasters. Once you have your time log completed, you will likely feel a bit of shock as it becomes obvious that you clearly don't have enough time to do everything you want, and that much of your time could be allocated to better uses. So the next thing to do is to identify activities that are wasting time or are not necessary for your mission and role. But how do you identify them? Personal time wasters. The DEAD tool we learned in What's Best Next is helpful here. Remember that there are four ways to reduce your tasks. 1. Delegate. Assign tasks to others or invite them to help. 2. Eliminate. Get rid of tasks that don't need to be done at all. 3. Automate. Get computers doing whatever you can. 4. Defer. Schedule tasks that don't need to be done now for later. You can use these four categories as a grid for finding tasks to remove. Though it's second in the acronym, I suggest starting with finding the tasks you can eliminate altogether. To do this, look at all the activities in your record and ask yourself, what would happen if this activity were not done at all? If the answer is nothing, then eliminate it. Most likely, a lot of things are taking a toll on your time and energy that will not be missed, and thus can unlock a fresh well of new time. The potential here is probably greater than you realize. Drucker notes, I have yet to see an executive, regardless of rank or station, who could not consign something like a quarter of the demands on his time to the waste paper basket without anybody's noticing their disappearance. Another set of tasks you can delete is ones that not only would not be missed if they weren't done, but that actively waste other people's time. That's right, you are probably doing some things that are not only wasting your time, but other people's time as well. This is a much overlooked category of time that we need to find and free up. You likely won't be able to identify these things on your own, which means you need to ask your coworkers what things you are doing that take away their time and do not contribute to their effectiveness. This takes boldness, but to ask this question and to ask it without being afraid of the truth is a mark of the effective executive. Note, however, that some of these items will be false positives. Sometimes you have to do your work in a certain way, and yet another person will suggest that it is unhelpful to them. For example, for various reasons, I need to have about 8 different categories in my calendar. This is because certain people need access to certain events and not others, and the categories make that possible. Once I had a temporary assistant who had been assigned to me say, "The way you do your calendars doesn't work for me." Aside from the fact that the top priority in this case was what worked for everybody, not just or chiefly her, there simply was no other way.